I have the Jerusalem Bible, so we have different versions here, so just follow along. They prostrated themselves in front of the dragon because he had given the beast his authority. Now remember, the dragon now is the symbol of Satan, or the ruler of the kingdom of darkness. And then he has given his authority to the dragon, to the first beast. And the first beast is Domitian, who is the emperor from 81 to 96, and also the emperor during what was called the Great Persecution of Christians. It's called the Domitian Persecution. John, do you have your hand up?
Yeah. What verse are you starting with?
Oh, starting with verse 4. Did I start with 4 or with 4?
Yes.
The Jerusalem Bible has the numbers off to the side, and you never know where it starts. They prostrated themselves. Here is the image now of the worship of the emperor worship. Who can compare with the beast? How could anybody defeat him? Remember how we talked about how the trust now, or the worship, was in the military power of the Roman Empire that was able to maintain the peace. For 42 months, the beast was allowed to mount its boasts and blasphemies and to do whatever it wanted. And it mouthed its blasphemies against God and against his name, his heavenly tent, and all those who are sheltered there. Now, 42 months is a significant number because this became a symbolic number for the shortness of the reign of oppression, or the hope that oppression will end. It was 42 months was the amount of time that it was believed that between the time when Antiochus Epiphanes came to power and the time he was defeated by the Maccabees, was 42 months. So this became a symbolic number of hope. It was really a way of, we could say it, you know, the people in Namibia, if they would say to each other, 42 months, 42 months, that would be a way of saying, this will end. You see? Mm-hmm. Then there's so many symbols there, I just don't have time. The blasphemy against the heavenly tent probably refers back to when Caligula tried to put a statue of Zeus in the Roman temple. Fortunately, his reign ended before that feat was accomplished. Then it was allowed to make war against the saints and conquer them and given power over every race, people, language, and nation. A very obvious image of the Roman Empire. And all the people of the world will worship it. That is, everybody whose name has not been written down since the foundation of the world in the book of life of the sacrificial lamb. Notice now how the author, John of Patmos, says, if anyone has ears to hear, let him listen. And I always smile when I read this, because I always think this is a secret way of reminding them. Now remember, I'm not a senile old man just writing word stories. I'm really working this now. Again, captivity for those who are destined for captivity, the sword for those who are to die by the sword. A newer way of saying, those who live by the sword will die by the sword. Those like the Roman Empire that depend on military might to maintain the peace, they will be ended by military might. Any of these things that are relevant for today at the two-fifths, as we are involved in a mad, insane arms race in the world today. I think it's at this point we start applying the book of Revelation to our time, and rather than playing around with concepts of Russia and the common market and the National Council of Churches and the World Council of Churches. The reason this is not applied like to the arms race is that is no longer playing around with the book. You see the difference? It's starting to let the book speak to our values. And then at that point, it becomes the Word of God. And whenever the word of God starts coming, it becomes extremely uncomfortable, and we'd rather go back and play our game. Do you see what I'm talking about? He who has ears to hear. For she who has ears to hear, let her hear. This is why the saints must have constancy and faith. This is the theme over and over again. No.
John, I'm sorry. Daniel. Am I understanding verses 10? Yes, verse 10. As a call for nonviolent resistance?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. In fact, I even have that written down in my own slide. It's the whole book is a call to nonviolent resistance.
And how would that square then with what's happening in the third world right now, mm-hmm. where our brothers and sisters there have chosen military resistance?
Mm-hmm. Did everyone hear the question? It's hard. We spent the entire winter struggling with that one question. We thought we had it all figured out reading John Howard Yoder, and then Paul Wee would come and talk to us about the Lutherans in Namibia, it's a question for a forum.
I see.
All I can say is I can say where the Book of Revelation comes out, that is in nonviolent resistance. And then it's another question of how do we answer the question about South Africa or Southern Africa resistance movement there that's taking up arms.
The Book of Life symbolism in the Book of Revelation, are you going to say more about that at another time, or is that kind of a symbolic way of saying keep the faith?
Mm-hmm. What I think John of Patmos does, he all these different images. I think the Book of Life I think it comes from Daniel, so I'm not sure. I'd have to look that up, but. What the book or what Revelation is really a book about identity, always a reminder of your identity. This picture of the Lamb's Book of Life is just another way of saying that your identity is in this book, your name is in this book. And early Christians had no trouble applying all of these symbols to their baptism. A whole different subject, but before your baptism, you turn to the west and to the darkness and to the kingdom of Satan and to the Roman Empire and to the circus and the theater and the forum and the Colosseum and the games of the Roman Empire, and you shouted no. And then you turn to the east to face the light, and you recited the creed and you shouted yes. And so he's making this constant. You said no, and by your name being in the book, it's your yes of your baptism. You can study the whole Book of Revelation as a book about baptism. The white robes of all the saints, the image of these people would be their baptismal robes. But what John is doing, he just piles image on image on image on image to keep these people from giving up the faith. And the Book of Life would be one. And I'd have to check exactly where it comes from in the Old Testament. Does that?
That's helpful, thank you.
Yeah. Now, when we get to verse 11, I won't read this, but we have the second beast emerging from the ground with two horns like a lamb that made a noise like a dragon. Sounds like the devil. Another way of saying that. This second beast was servant to the first beast and extended its authority everywhere, making the world and its all his people worship the first beast, which had had the fatal wound and had been healed. Okay, I want to first say a word about the second beast and then about the fatal wound, and then we get to go back to our chart. By the way, an executive decision was made by Mary Schramm, who's the
director of the bookstore, and his charts are free. However, she said if you want to make a 10-cent donation. So they'll be available. John?
In order to get out of the door, that way.
I'll have them available afterwards, and there are two sheets, and take one of each, and then you'll see where they fit together, and then scotch tape. You can scotch tape them together. There's two thicknesses of paper, one for the convenience, a thinner one for folding up and inserting in your Bible, or if you want a thicker one that will last longer, they're both free. It's a marvelous chart. You know, have you ever, I'm going to go off. Have you ever wondered what was going on in the trial of Jesus when all of a sudden Pilate was sending Jesus over to Herod? And then all of a sudden Herod was sending Jesus back to Pilate. You wonder, what were two kings doing in Jerusalem at the same time? You know, and the chart here helps you. When you see the cross here, the crucifixion, the Palestine was really divided into three parts. And Pilate was one of the procurators here. And then Herod was Herod Antipas, who was up in Galilee, who was down in Jerusalem. That is, he had a palace in Jerusalem when he wanted to get away from it all for a while. I mean, all kinds of little things clear up when you have this chart. I don't know why I have to advertise it when it's free. Back to the second beast. The second beast are the bureaucrats. They are the these are the people that check in the morning at the desk and do their job, and then at night they go home and they have a good family life. If you saw the Holocaust on television, the movie Holocaust, remember how the SS, I forgot what his name was in the... But one of the striking things was how when he went home, he kind of left it all behind, his campaign to exterminate the Jews. And remember the night when he and his family were just sitting around the panel singing Christmas carols? Now, this is the second beast. These are the common, decent, ordinary, moral people that in a very sane way, with sane minds, go to the office and enforce the system and make it work. And again, you have to, this would be a long forum to say, you know, what is the second beast today, and how in a way maybe we're all involved in some way in second beastness. But these were the people who sat at the tables, and they were called priests, which is a little threatening. And as I said, emperor worship took an hour and 5 minutes a year. As I said yesterday, the hour was standing in line, the 5 minutes was kind of doing it. And the second beast person would make out your card, and then he would watch, and there would be two witnesses probably, that would watch you take some incense, put it on the altar before the statue of Domitian, and then all you had to say was, I said three words yesterday, it's three words in English, it's two words in Greek, which they used, and it was simply to say, Caesar is Lord. Burn your incense, and then this is a card you would get. We, the representatives of the emperor, Cyrenos, and Hermas, these were the names of the two second beast persons, have seen you sacrificing. They give you this card, you'd put it in whatever. Have you ever thought everybody in every age has some kind of a wallet? You hung it on yourself or something. But you'd put that in, and this is your identification paper now to show that you are a patriotic Roman citizen. And all the Book of Revelation is saying is, don't get a card. Because to get a card is to deny the Lord Jesus Christ and to give up your faith. And we say 5 minutes a year, and I'll be a Christian the rest of the year. And the book of Revelation says no. You cannot worship Domitian and worship Jesus. And you make a choice. And then it shows how these priests do miracles. They persuade them to put up a statue in honor of the beast. This is the statue of Domitian that had been wounded by the sword and still lived. And talk a minute about this healed wound. Now, sometimes the beast, we're talking just about Domitian, sometimes the beast is a whole line of Roman empires. And when you read about the beast being wounded, people there knew very much that it would refer back to the year 68, when Nero committed suicide. And it looked at that time like the Roman Empire was finished by these terrible civil wars, 3 different emperors in 1 month. And then it was Vespasian then that took power and again brought the Roman peace. So it was the beast who was wounded and then healed. See the symbolism. And again, this was obvious to people that first read this. It's just not obvious to us because we don't know the background. Then down to 16, he compelled everyone, small and great, rich and poor, slave and citizen, to be branded on the right hand or on the forehead, and made it illegal for anyone to buy or sell anything unless he had been branded with the name of the beast or with the number of its name. Now listen to the writer. I love this. He says, there is need for shrewdness here. If anyone is clever enough, he may interpret the number of the beast. It is the number of a man. The number is 666. Can you imagine now running to your home to write down this and figure it out? Okay, 666. First, the mark, most likely the mark of the beast. The best explanation is it's your card. Notice it says you cannot buy and sell. Being a Christian for these people during the Domitian persecution is an economic decision. Because before you can be part of the economic life of the Roman Empire, you have to show your card. This is powerful, is it? Because it's from what Joe said last night, how South Africa is controlled by cards. Nothing new at all. South Africa and the black people of South Africa are held in oppression by their cards. It's a little different here. They were really held by not, but all the people were under a tyranny. See, and if you didn't have a card, just as in South Africa today, if a black didn't have a card, he would be immediately, I would assume, be arrested. And that's the case. And without showing your card, you cannot take part in the economic life. So to be a Christian is a decision to be poor, to decision to lose everything. Okay, 666. Did you ever, when you were a kid, have secret codes? Where like A, and like A, B, C, D, E, and A would be 1. B would be 2. And if you'd really want to fool people, you'd start with Z and that would be 1. Y would be 2. And your secret friend would know how to decode this. Now, both the Hebrews and the Greeks had letter number codes. And commentators have deciphered this, that I don't know how to do this, but if you take, I don't know the exact way, but if you take Nero Caesar, apply the proper number codes for each of the letters in Nero Caesar, it adds up to 666. And this becomes clearer when Nero was remembered by the Christians now in the 90s. Nero was in the 60s. And in the 90s now, they look back on the 60s and Nero's as the time of the great persecution of the church, the last great persecution of the church. So in ways, Domitian was thought of as a resurrection of Nero.
Yeah, I was reading in one book about Nero Caesar. They were telling how he was going to be the Antichrist and all. Mm-hmm. And then there was this other book I was reading where it had the numerical Titan was the numerical in Greek, 2666.
Mm-hmm. Say that again.
The word Titan in numerically in Greek added up to 666.
Yeah, I could add to that that different people have come up with about 40 different things, you know, so for this. And we're not sure even about the one I said. I need to point that out. To me, it's the most, it seems to fit into the historical situation, because people had this figured out for Hitler, and I'm sure you could even figure it out for Ronald Reagan or Jimmy Carter. And anytime you want to interpret the Bible you want, the way you want, you can do it.
What is the reference there to the bureaucrats, or whether they were working signs and wonders?
Oh, they were magicians. This is nothing that is just part of the act. In fact, you have that in other places, and like in the Book of Acts, where Paul meets up with workers of magic. You know, and probably they weren't that much different than a magician today. The only difference, a magician today is used more for entertainment. These people use their magic ability to kind of show them, again, to demonstrate the power. The number 666 is a very possible explanation. So, okay, now, just to look at chapter 13, now what we have here now from the chapter is Christians in Western Turkey, in these churches, who have denounced the powers of evil in their baptism, but now who are being persecuted because they do not have the card, because they have not worshipped the emperor, and some of them are leaving to worship the emperor because it makes life more comfortable. John on the island of Patmos, a prison island, sending this letter, using apocalyptic language to plead with them to keep the faith and not give in by going for their 5-minute emperor worship during the year. Okay, does that give a background now so we can move on? Are there any questions before we continue? Okay. No, I'm going to show some slides now, and those in the back are going to have to really squint because I have it on the size of a television. Also, slide number 3 is stuck every time, so when we move to slide 3, everybody think, not stick. Teflon. And if it does stick, to show my lack of faith. The first slides are only related to the Book of Revelation indirectly, but I want to show them because the most important thing when you're reading the Book of Revelation is to not think of it as as we would as Westerners, an exact plan that plots out the future, and we use our rational minds to say this is this, and this is this, and this is this, and this is this. Rather, we have to think of the Book of Revelation as a painting. And you have to read the Book of Revelation as you would go into an art museum and look at a piece of art. You have to let the Book of Revelation enter inside of you and speak to you as not as a philosopher talking to you, or an essayist, or a future predictor, but as an artist, painting beautiful pictures with words. And to really get this in mind, I want to show just a few pictures of Picasso's Guernica. And I think there are some perfect tie-ins between Picasso's Guernica and the Book of Revelation. the background of Guernica was the first saturation bombing of a civilian population in the history of humanity. When Nazi planes flying for Franco dropped bombs on the Spanish city of Guernica, devastated the city, and killing for the first time in history masses of non-combatants, women, children, elderly, animals. And Picasso, enraged over this first act in history of such terror, painted this painting we're going to see. Now you can see this in New York. I think it's still at the Museum of Modern Art, and it would stretch probably from here all the way down to the end of the wall. That's why you lose the impact of it unless you come up to about here. But I'll maybe at the end of the class I'll put this one back on so you can come and see the details. But what it is, it's just all kinds of symbols of war and violence and destruction. And the symbols, the same messages repeated in motifs all over the painting of the terror of war for humanity. And anywhere you look in the picture, you get, except one place, I'll talk, anywhere you look in the painting, you get the same message. He repeats and repeats and repeats the motifs. That one is sideways, it should be. I'm not going to comment on these now, just... we went by three. a dead baby in the arms of a mother. You know how this would be, this would go back to the Great Persecution. Just the colors, all grays. The inhumanity.
These are colored slides.
Now this is, you know, this is a color slide, right? Now the one motif in this picture that stands out as different from the whole rest of the picture is there's a broken sword, a dead soldier's hand grasping the broken sword. The arm is disembodied, it's what's the word? Separated. And then out of that broken sword and that dead hand is growing a delicate flower. Yeah, and what Picasso, without knowing it, I think, has painted the Book of Revelation in this Guernica. There is a closer. It is a delicate flower coming out of the broken sword. Now, I'll go on from here, but now, I'm going to move over here, and you can come and see this closer, but the Book of Revelation is really divided into seven parts. And you, all through the book, John has seven parts, then seven churches, the seven judgments, almost everything is in sevens. And it's very similar to how Picasso repeats the same motif, that you can almost enter, just like entering this picture any place and getting the same message, you can enter the Book of Revelation almost any time, and John is saying exactly the same thing. Okay, now, this is the Catacomb of Priscilla in Rome. The only thing here that isn't from the first century is a light bulb. Okay, so these were the burial. Here's an old lamp here that was original. These are the burial grounds of the early Christians. And here's another example of how in the burial grounds they found comfort from apocalyptic literature. This is a picture of the risen Jesus. And on either side of the risen Jesus, here is Daniel and Susanna. Daniel, the apocalyptic figure, and then Susanna, which is a story in a book that isn't in the Bible, but one of the extra-biblical writings. And Susanna, a woman who kept her faith at the time of the Great Persecution. And I think it's amazing that they have, you know, they have a man and a woman, almost like the early Christians could look and they could see an example of a man who kept his faith in persecution, a woman who kept her faith in persecution. Okay, now we're going to the island of Patmos, and it's just a beautiful Mediterranean island. And this was a prison island now at the time of the Roman Empire, where people they didn't want to kill. Now, John probably was not killed because of the decision that he not be a martyr at this time, but rather he was brought here and taken away from the churches. And you have to think of the churches now in Western Turkey at this time, the way the Roman government looked at them, they were subversive organizations. And the reason they were subversive organizations is that they demanded of their members civil disobedience in the form of not worshiping the emperor. Now, from the top of the island, there's a beautiful monastery, and you get a view of the whole island here in the little town of Patmos here. And the amazing thing is when John talks in the book of Revelation about the sea of glass, remember that picture in the book? When you're up here and look out over the sea, it looks like glass. He was looking at images around him when he was writing this book. This is from the top of the monastery.
It's interesting to note when you're on the top of that monastery that on a clear day that the sky and the sea just go together.
Yeah, you don't even see it.
It looks like the whole island is floating in space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't. It's to just sit there in silence and look at what he looked at. It, you know, just the mystery of the sight. The monks there, look at this beautiful way they put these pots going up the stairs. Nothing to do with Revelation. Now, down below the monastery, this is a traditional site, which, you know, is someone's guess way back sometime, of where John sat when he wrote the book of Revelation. And in fact, it is so definite there that here's a window that looks out from this building. And in the exact spot where the Revelation was written, there are candles. But, well, eight burning and two not burning. I don't know what that
is. What's the symbol?
Yeah, we know that this probably isn't accurate, but what it does is it ties something like John to earth. You know, that here was a man sitting. If it wasn't here, it was probably within 2 miles. It's just another scene from the window. Now, this is the exact motorcycle that the book of Revelation was carried. This is a map of the Roman Empire at this time, and you can see the white is where there are Christian communities. This is a little later, about the year 180. The white is where there are Christian churches, and you see how the strength of the Christian church numerically now is what today Western Turkey. Now it was where the Christian church had its real strength, where the missionary task had resulted in almost the total probably conversion of many, not total, but you see how of all the places in the Roman Empire, the Christian church here was the greatest threat because it was the place of greatest numerical strength. Now, I want to look now just a little to give you a little image again of Domitian. When we go back to Augustus, who was called the Prince of Peace, reigned from 27 BC to 14 AD, Augustus was a fairly secure person. And you know a secure, this isn't always accurate, but you can almost know, you can gauge your own security by the amount of stuff you either do or do not have surrounding yourself. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Yeah, the more stuff we put around us, that almost, you know, in other words, our ego strength has to come then from outside. Augustus had the Roman virtue, the old Roman virtue of modesty, and his home that he lived in during his entire reign was probably about the size here of this room. And he had no need at all to live in great luxury. And this is just the courtyard of his home, just a very modest, and he wanted to identify with kind of the average Roman citizen by living in a house that was similar to theirs. Now here's a model of the city of Rome at the time of Domitian, and this was built by Mussolini. It's marvelous. It covers about the area of this room. And these buildings are like about this high. If you ever go to Rome, this is it was part of Mussolini's attempt to kind of recapture the glory of ancient Rome. And he failed at everything else, but he did this beautiful model. And now, what is a contrast here? All of this stuff here now is Domitian's palace. Domitian was a great builder. He not only built this, but he built all over the empire to establish his glory and his power and to show that he was the Lord and God. Here was a great Roman circus, the chariot races, and Domitian could sit here in his private courtyard right outside of his house and watch as people were killed and all the violence and the terror and also the excitement of the chariot races. Here was what's called the Colosseum, today more correctly called the Flavian Amphitheater. This is all the grounds now of Domitian's palace, the beast of the Book of Revelation. All the archaeological digs of his palace grounds. Domitian even had his own private circus where he could watch all by himself chariot races right in his backyard. And the great circus Maximus then was behind this and down the hill. It just gives you a little idea of the insecurity is the kindest thing to say about this man. And now when we go out into other cities of the Roman Empire, we see all of the results of Domitian and his image. He wanted to be the great builder, so he would be remembered forever. And this now was the theater, or the forum in the city of Ephesus. And this was in this part of Turkey. When I say Turkey, I'm using today's word for this country. And Ephesus was one of the great cities of the Roman world. And here was one of the Christian communities that was tortured, and were losing their jobs. They were being killed because they would not worship the emperor. And looking at this slide of Ephesus, I'd just like to read the first letter to the churches, chapter 2. Write to the angel of the church in Ephesus and say, here is the message of the one who holds the seven stars in his right hand and who lives surrounded by the seven golden lampstands. I know all about you, how hard you work, and how much you put up with. I know you cannot stand wicked men, and how you tested the impostors who called themselves apostles and proved they were liars. I know too that you have patience and have suffered for my name without growing tired. Nevertheless, I have this complaint to make. You have less love now than you used to. Think where you were before you fell. Repent and do as you used to do at first, or else, if you will not repent, I will come to you and take your lampstand from its place. It is in your favor, nevertheless, that you loathe as I do what the Nicolaitans are doing. If anyone has ears to hear, let him hear what the Spirit is saying to the churches. Those who prove victorious, I will feed from the tree of life set in God's paradise. I like to read that letter and then localize it to the slide. Paul lived here in Ephesus and worked. And this is a library in Ephesus. A tremendous archaeological thing. And you have a feeling like you're like in the city of Cleveland or something, and you see, you can look as almost as far as your eye can travel, ruins of a magnificent city. Now this is an actual, this is an actual first century toilet, public toilet area in downtown Ephesus. And what I like about this, it seldom is said, but it would almost be certain that the Apostle Paul went here. There's no question about it. Where else would you go when you're preaching all day downtown? Now, this area, which is near the center of Ephesus, was the Domitian Temple. Now, here we get close now to the situation in the book of Revelation. It would have been now right in the spot where the temple was built, and inside the temple, this magnificent statue of my Lord and my God, Domitian. And this is where the second beast bureaucrats would sit, and where you would go by the table and pick up your card after you had taken a pinch of incense and worship Domitian. And this is a picture of how the Domitian's temple would have looked at this time. Well, that's all the slides today. We'll jump back into the book again. We're 5 minutes away. But how I'm going to close today, and then we'll pick up from there, is starting with the first chapter. I'm going to have someone read it, but first I'll say this, and that will help. What the writer of the Revelation now is saying over and over again, and see if you can start to feel this for yourself and apply it to our time. And I do this, I'll say it, and then I hope over these days when we study, it'll start sinking in more and more. I think part of my experience of being in Holden for a whole year was for what I'm going to say now, sinking in deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. And it's really started with John's presentations on Thomas Merton. Instead of saying I'm going to say that, I'll just say it. But what the book of Revelation is telling these people is what you see is not real, what you do not see is real. Okay, I'll repeat that. What you see is not real. What you do not see is real. Okay, let's break that down. What do the people see as they look around them in their life? What do they see? What is just obvious to everybody? Okay, the power of Rome. Okay. If anything to these people in this time is reality, it's the power of Rome. It's all over. There's Roman soldiers all over. The power of the Roman Empire. They've conquered the world. They're keeping the peace. They have the most powerful military establishment that has ever come along in the history of humanity. If anything is real, it has to be this. And if you're going to be a realistic person, open your eyes and see where the truth is. And that truth is in the Roman Empire. If you want to survive in this life and have a happy life, open up your eyes and just see reality and go along with reality. Okay, the greatest compliment a person can ever pay to a Christian is to say you're not being realistic. When someone is saying that, then they're finally catching. move on. Okay. And we're going to come back to this theme again and again and again. This is what everybody, if you had a vote in the Roman Empire, this side would win by an overwhelming majority, that this is reality. And what we just read is what the symbolism, that all he does is put a big number 42 over this, which comes from the, this is how long Antiochus Epiphanes reigned. Okay, then what you do not see is real. And now the back to the meaning of the word apocalypse is just the lifting up of a veil. And now what the whole book is going to be now is I'm just going to lift up this veil, place it over here, and just for a few moments while you're reading this book, you're going to see a wounded lamb, a crucified Jesus, enthroned as the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, who will reign forever and ever and ever and ever, Prime Minister of Prime Minister, President of Presidents. Okay, I've taken the veil away, now look and see. And what you think is real is not real, and what looks like it isn't real is real. All of this, all the book of Revelation is an invitation to be crazy.